The Guardian.
Welcome to another Film Weekly. I'm Jason Solomons. This week I tune in, turn on and drop out with Bernard Rose, director of Mr. Nice, starring Reese Ifans as everyone's favourite drug dealer, Howard Marks. And we visit Afghanistan twice this week, for fun in Mr. Nice, for fury in Restrepo, a documentary telling the close-up story of one US platoon in the heat of armed conflict. Zan Brooks joins me to review some of the week's other releases, including Zac Efron in The Death and Life of Charlie St. Cloud, and Gordon Gekko is back in Wall Street 2, Money Never Sleeps. Yes, it's the new opiate of the masses, it's Film Weekly. Howard Marks, otherwise known as Mr. Nice, has become a household name over the past decade, selling tens of thousands of copies of his autobiography and backing out theatres and festivals around the UK with his rambunctious tales of his life as a drug dealer. Well, now his story has been committed to celluloid, with his Welsh compatriot Reese Ifans playing Marks himself, and his long-suffering wife Judy played by Chloe Sevigny. The screenplay and direction is by Bernard Rose, a British director, best known for his visceral, low-budget collaborations with Danny Houston on Ivan's Ecstasy and the Kreutzer Sonata, featured on Film Weekly only a few months ago. And here is Mr. Nice, or Reese Ifans, playing Howard Marks, being lured into the spying game by a very British intelligence officer, played by Christian Mackay.
Are you asking me to be a spy?
Howard, I haven't just turned up on your doorstep without doing my research. Will you help us?
How can I help you?
We need people to gather information for us.
Bloody hell, you are. You're a spy.
Howard, keep it down.
This is not a James Bond movie.
Well, it certainly feels like it. You're recruiting me. You're asking me to be a member of MI6.
Well, the government doesn't ever officially acknowledge the existence of what you call MI6. However, we do need to keep abreast of things. And we do employ a loose network of people who do things for us. You travel in circles we can't penetrate. We just might need your help. Sort of a patriotic thing, old chap.
And I imagine this would give me a certain amount of protection.
And when I met up with Bernard Rose to talk about Mr. Nice and the making of the film, I suggested to him that this was a quintessentially British story.
Well, yeah, I always used to say kind of half tongue-in-cheek that it was the Lawrence of Arabia of drug movies, because he has that sort of British explorer side to him that he wants to travel the globe.
Yeah. he does it very well as well, but presumably the budget wasn't big enough for you to actually travel the globe in this.
Well, actually, it was shot in two different countries, which is obviously they're representing a lot more different countries. I think it's set in 12 different countries, but we did shoot the film half in Wales and half in Spain.
But it kind of gave it a nice kind of sort of tone, really, of darkness and light, that it kept moving towards the kind of grey drabness of England and then this kind of sunlit other world where sort of not drugs can take you, but where drug dealing could take you, where sort of the kind of the sunny place you go to when riches are taken.
That's right. I think we did all the Northern European stuff in Wales and we did all the sunny stuff in Spain. So that was kind of how it divided up.
And I always think that was the kind of thing that you were going for, a sort of duality here in Mr. Nice, in that there is a kind of hedonism that is attractive and yet it comes with the downside.
Well, yeah, I think, you know, like any of these stories, it's all going great until it's not. And then it kind of goes pear-shaped very quickly and he ends up dealing with the consequences and the chaos in his life that he's created.
Yeah, he's just another of your characters that have been doing that of late. I mean, you did it with Danny Houston so brilliantly in Ivan's Ecstasy and recently in Kreutzer Sonata, two films which are superb. I think dealing with the kind of almost a pact with the devil one your protagonist seemed to make. And I think that Howard Marks is just another person who's done that.
Yeah, I can see that. I mean, in a sense, he's a simple hedonist and he's kind of innocent and he's kind of a child of the 60s and he doesn't see that what he's doing is anything wrong. And and putting two fingers up to the establishment is something that everyone he knows applauds him for. And then, of course, in the 80s, the establishment fights back and they arm themselves to the teeth with Reagan and they become the DEA. and the war on drugs starts, and these people aren't messing around. They want to destroy him.
Mm.
And he doesn't spot that change, I think. And so there's a kind of innocence there. And it leads to his downfall.
Mm. The thing is with how when Mr. Nice the book came out, and everyone kind of, you know, loads of stoners went to the kind of to see him kind of in action, and he was invited to festivals and everything, and he sort of became a kind of sort of pin-up, did Howard Marks himself. Was there a danger that with film you can't quite do what the book can more easily do? The book can sort of say, well, I'm a liberal tract, and I'm kind of there, and I'm kind of pro drugs, and you know, the drug enforcement is failing and all of that kind of thing, and I'm a kind of comic character. But with film, is there a sense that you can't quite be as free?
Yeah, I don't think you are constrained. I think that the only constraints where I think the book does differ from the film is that obviously the film is a depiction of the events as opposed to a description of the events, so that Howard talks about things and he glosses over certain things. And I think in the book he does gloss over the consequences and the chaos that he calls. But in the film you can't ignore it, because in a sense it's staring you in the face. And I think that, you know, it's one thing, for example, for him to write in the book, you know, I got shingles and got abscesses in my gums and I had to have all my teeth removed. And it's quite another to show a scene where somebody's doing that in a dentist's chair.
Yeah.
But in a sense, it probably means that the film is somewhat more balanced than the book, but I don't think it has a different meaning or a different conclusion in that sense. I think it comes to the same conclusion, which is that there are two issues here. One is the prohibition of drugs, and the other one is the issues of addiction, and they're not the same thing.
Mm.
And I think you could fairly say that Howard has extensively addressed the issue of prohibition, both publicly and in his book, but hasn't really addressed the issue of addiction.
Mm-hmm. An addiction on a personal level. Is in the film he's sort of addicted to the drug itself, but also to the lifestyle.
Yeah, I think that's what happens to people. And I think that, you know, these things become anything that gives you a little adrenaline buzz becomes something that it's a button that human beings want to push again, and it becomes very difficult to stop.
Mm. Even in Candyman, which I am delighted to say to be speaking to the maker of Candyman, which is, I'm not a big horror movie buff, actually. It is my favourite horror movie. It is the scariest movie I have ever seen. It's the only movie that gives me and gave me nightmares. But even in that film, There's a pact. There's someone you have to stare at your own reflection and dare a candy man to come. You have to say it. So there's an addiction to even saying that as a horror experience, and that's something that I think is kind of, I don't know, consciously or not, going through your work. You know, the DVD I've got of Ivan's Ecstasy as a line of cocaine, it's on a mirrored surface. There are reflections and duality in your work. And even as I'm staring at you now, there's a picture of Howard Marks there, but with his sunglasses reflecting back again.
Yeah, no, I see where you're going with this, as they say.
I'm only kind of going. You went there first. I'm just kind of following you.
No, I think that there's an element of truth in that. Of course, I mean, I'm glad to hear in a way you say that there are similarities between my work, because the thing that I'm always getting people say is, how come you make so many different films? You make horror films, you make these biographies, or you make these little Tolstoy adaptations.
Mm.
And to me, they're always the same.
If I may say, I think you were, I don't know if this is a problem with you, and maybe you should get yourself examined, but you're better at the hell than you are than the highs. Your descents into hell, I think, are remarkable, always, in all of your films. It's those moments where it tips and the walls close in, and I find those are expertly done.
I do enjoy doing that stuff. I do get disturbed by films that seem too happy sometimes. Like certain feel-good films make me kind of give me the heebie-jeebies. Yeah. It's true.
But that's why I'm saying to you about this film that you may be constrained by a moral code, because in a film, can you sort of say, well, this is a pro-drugs film, we should go all out for kind of, you know, making drugs legal, a legalizing movie, which it isn't a legalizing movie, because you have to show that there is a downside to it.
Yeah, I think To make a movie like that would be absurd too, because it's a much more complicated issue than that. I mean, personally, I absolutely think drugs should be legalized, but I think all of them should be legalized. I think that the war that's going on in Mexico could be ended if the USA legalized cocaine. It wouldn't stop one person taking cocaine to have this war going on in Mexico that's causing tremendous pains, violence, social unrest, destabilizing the government of Mexico. Mm. I mean, it seems wrong, but the flip side of that, and I believe just as passionately, is if you would ask me What do I personally do? I say smoking marijuana, never mind cocaine, smoking marijuana is extremely dangerous, and I wouldn't do it, and I don't do it.
Yeah. No, I'm not looking at some kind of tabloid honey trap here. Get you to confess to an enormous drug habit.
But I think it's an important point to make there, because I personally think that it's include a lot of other drugs in the same category, like alcohol, which is probably the most dangerous drug there is. Legality is not the same thing as addiction, and I think that we've become confused by these two issues, and it's caused a lot of social harm. It doesn't help addicts to criminalize them.
It must have been difficult for you when you've got a protagonist who is A, played by Reese Ifans, who's roguish, naturally a roguish kind of presence on screen, and a likable rogue normally in all those. In fact, he reminded me most of the Peter Cook thing he did here when he was playing here, and Peter Cook was, you know, brilliant, but, you know, bit of a tosser. And I think that, you know, there's that in Reese's portrayal of Howard Marks. I don't know Howard Marks at all. And I think that's quite difficult, because you're dealing with someone who is complicit in drug smuggling, which is then, you know, because it's illegal, it does sort of fund IRA terrorism in that time. There is a complicity in it, isn't all kind of rosy. There is, no. You know, murder and destruction at, you know, even though this guy is kind of all doing it because, you know, skinning up is great fun, but actually there is a kind of trail of destruction which he's not ignorant of.
No, he's not, and the film isn't either, and I think the film shows very kind of concisely the link between drugs and terrorism.
You mean with the David Tudis character?
Yeah, with the IRA, that's right. And I think that, you know, the point is that if you have the lead character of a film, whatever they're doing, it's one of the weird natures of cinema that you go with the lead character, even if they do all kinds of unsympathetic negative things. And one of my favorite examples of that, which of course was to the detriment of the movie in terms of its intended purpose, was Fahrenheit 9/11, where Michael Moore makes this, he obviously just wants to really explain what a rotten, evil guy George Bush is, but by making him the central character of his movie, you actually come out of that movie and you think, well, actually George Bush is kind of funny.
Did you?
Well, he has kind of good jokes in the movie.
Yeah,
he gets a lot of laughs, and that even if you're saying somebody's evil, it's hard in a weird way not to kind of feel something for them by the end of the movie. That's why it's so hard to make a film about Hitler that's not kind of in some way either absurd or reprehensible, because when somebody's the lead character of a film, it doesn't matter who they are, you start to feel for them. You know, Hannibal Lecter, you feel for. Yeah. You feel for somebody who does as rotten as that. So, you know, and also, you know, Howard's a gangster, but we admire gangsters on film.
Yeah.
And we're used to gangsters being violent when they're confronted, and Howard is a pacifist, and whenever he gets into a gangster-type situation, he gets everybody stoned.
Yeah.
Which, of course, is the whole point, really.
It might be one solution. Ecstasy did solve football hooliganism for a very brief while back in the 80s, although we said it did.
Well, there you go, you see. It's just about what chemical state you're in.
Yeah. Well, they're always in very intriguing positions in your films, and I'd another addition to them. It's always nice to see you, and thanks for coming on Film Weekly to talk about Mr. Nice, who's both Mr. Nasty and Mr. Nice as well, which is a great little title. I think there's a difference when the film and the book. I'm not an adherent slave to the book at all, especially because I think it's an exercise in unreliable narrative, and it's interesting to see how that kind of makes it onto the screen. What you do as a can you have an unreliable camera as your lead, which you have, you know, you kind of slalom between all of those problems.
Well, yeah, I mean, the film is an adaptation of Howard's book, and it is Howard's story according to Howard, but I think the film makes it clear that's what it is, that he's telling the story. So, we're buying his version of events. But that's all anybody's story is.
Yeah. And thank you for giving it yours, Bernard Rose. Cheers. Well, nice to meet you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks to Bernard Rose there, and Mr. Nice, his film, is on general release here in the UK from Friday the 8th. of October. Now, joining me to engage in the illicit trade of critical opinion is The Guardian's very own Mr. Nice, Zan Brooks. Zan will be reviewing Mr. Nice off the back of that. We'll look at Wall Street 2 as well to see if greed is really good. You can tell me about the death and life of Charlie St. Cloud, and I'll fill you in on a little bit of animation that's going on. A Town Called Panic is out. You've been listening to a bit of the music, actually, on the show, so I'll tell you a little bit about that little bonkers Belgian escapade. But we'll start with Mr. Nice, because we heard Bernard Rose talking there about sort of the intentions of the film, and I think it's quite clear that I don't quite think he pulled off the idea of the film that he had in his head.
Possibly not, and there was a sense that he was slightly inhibited, maybe by it. It's basically taking the Howard Marks autobiography, you know, to the letter, isn't it?
Have you read this? Are you? I read.
We always get into trouble when we say we haven't read it. So I have read at least half of it, but a long time ago.
It's not a literary masterpiece, I have to say. I mean, everyone was reading it, though, at the point.
It was,
everyone
yeah.
Everyone who read it, it was too stoned to actually finish it.
Exactly, yeah. So maybe I've read it really recently and just can't remember.
Can't remember anything. it was a sort of lovable rogue kind of first-person narrative. And the film, I think, sort of struggles to recreate that, even though it does that kind of Brechtian thing that a lot of films do now, where they kind of, I'm the guy on stage. Bronson did it.
Yeah, Bronson did it a lot better.
This feels
like those bits were sort of tacked on. And so you've got him against a sort of 60s, 70s backdrop and sort of Carnaby Street Britain and things like that. You've got the weird device of Rhys Ifans playing him as a sort of 14-year-old. And yet the rest of it is played, you know, very straight.
I think there are some good bits in it, though, some good moments. I quite like it when he goes into hell. I thought that was rather good, that
yeah,
bit.
Yeah, that was all right. I had a problem with Rhys Ifans, though. But then I always do.
Well, has he slept with your wife? Has he?
Well, he's always trying
yeah,
to.
Yeah, I bet he is.
Yeah.
What's your problem here with,
I don't
on
know.
Screen?
I find him a sort of peculiarly enraging actor. He's a sort of self-regarding, self-hugging presence, and maybe that is fitting to play Howard Marks, who's a fairly, always gives the impression of being slightly pleased of himself.
It's not the film that I kind of wanted it to be at all, really, and I get the feeling that it's not the film.
Bernard Rose is a brilliant director, and yeah, he will make more brilliant films, yeah, but this isn't it.
He is making a third film with Danny Houston,
yeah,
he told me about the, outside that interview that goes with the Kreutzer Sonata and Ivan's Exorcist, he's the third one of those,
right,
which is just going to be brilliant,
yeah,
of course.
So, well, let's wait for that.
Yeah, let's wait for that and we'll review it again. But, you know, good stab at Mr. Nice. Let's talk about Wall Street 2, because money never sleeps, Zan. Certainly my money never sleeps, because it's always going out of my bank account and never coming back in. Mm. You might have a similar problem, I don't know. The credit crunch has bitten us all, and I think Oliver Stone thought it was time to revive, given that bankers were top of the agenda again, to revive his Gordon Gekko. Here he is with Shia LaBeouf.
Mr. Gekko, I'm in love with your daughter. And I'd be honored. Why's that funny?
My daughter hasn't spoken to me in years, and you know it. She blames me for brother's overdose and just about every other disaster that's hit this world since Nintendo. You don't think it's strange she's dating somebody from Wall Street?
Why?
Because she hates it.
Michael Douglas is back. He looks all right in this film. Obviously, the real-life
yeah,
tragedy has kind of taken over him since, not looking quite so good. But it was good to see Gordon Gekko back on screen.
It was. And, you know, this is... Maybe I will come round to Rhys Ifans in the way that I've come round to Michael Douglas, because I used to find Michael Douglas quite an irritating presence.
Yeah.
And now I really like
it. It's that V-neck jumper from
the
Basic
yeah,
Instinct.
Yeah, it is, isn't it? And yet here he's great. And it's a real proper old-style Hollywood star performance,
yeah,
this. I mean, obviously he's coming bearing a lot of baggage. We know who Gordon Gekko is, so a lot of the legwork's been done. And yet this isn't an indulgent sort of reprise. He's properly kind of bringing some heavyweight muscle to this film, and it needs it.
Yeah, it does. I mean, I think he is sort of the best thing in it.
He is, by
quite some distance. In fact, the rest of it is rather disappointing. I was expecting Oliver Stone, you know, who's the man who's kind of been, you know, telling us about what's going on south of the border, although he didn't quite predict the Ecuadorian riots in his last film, South of the Border, although he did have an interview with Carrera.
He did, yeah.
Didn't kind of quite predict what was going to go on. But you'd have thought he'd have been politically kind of sly here and really attacked Wall Street. Sort of gets a bit bogged. In the end, I can't work out if he actually kind of admires these bankers.
But isn't that always, that's always been the problem with Oliver Stone, and that it's the real, he's a sort of tabloid filmmaker, you know, with all that entails, in that he's he's in love with what he's criticising. And it totally compromises his message. He's also a very crude filmmaker. There's a lot of talk of bubbles in this film. There's a sort of scene where Shia LaBeouf, who's playing this sort of Wall Street hotshot, is walking with Frank Langella, who's like the old Wall Street lion. And Frank Langella is saying, you know, we're all going down. And then it cuts to a bubble in the sky. And then later on, the Shia LaBeouf character is romancing Gecko's daughter, who's played by Kerry Mulligan. And Gecko says, relationships, they're like bubbles. And you think, how many more bubbles are we going to have? It's like a foam bath.
It is, but these bubbles, you know, they're precious. They burst, you see.
They burst, and this is what he's trying to tell us. But he's hammering these bubbles.
Do you know who I mean, I don't like Shia LaBeouf at all in anything, ever. He was quite good in
he's
Holes.
He's a bit of an insipid presence, isn't he? Mm. You know, he's okay here. Frank Langella's all right here.
Raiders of the Lost Ark thing, whatever.
That was rubbish.
Terrible.
That was rubbish. I like Josh Brolin.
Yes, I do too.
Here he plays the new villain because Gecko's a sort of semi-reformed.
It's sort
character.
Of a problem though for me because you've got Gecko back and he's the big villain, but because he's now kind of slightly licking his wounds and regretting his greed, even though, and they kind of use a sting on this kind of, on Josh Brolin, but that's too many villains. I think it kind of was the first film worked because there was just the one villain. I found completely the second half of the film completely lost.
The second half of the film is a stinker, and it's very strange because actually for the first half of it I was really enjoying it.
Yeah, me too.
In a sort of brash, gaudy way, like, it was good.
Yeah, and I quite enjoyed Kerry Mulligan being the soft kind of centre of it, the female. And then after all, I was like, well, just because she's a girl, why does she got to be all kind of mushy?
And Susan Sarandon as the rattled old mum who's a real estate agent, but the subprime bubble has burst. And so she's smoking, chain smoking like a lunatic. And
she does a lot of playing the rattled old mum.
She does. She did
days.
It in Lovely Bones as well. It's kind of sad.
Yeah.
And it's a real hammy turn. But then, you know, in this sort of film, if you're not doing a hammy turn, you really shouldn't be there.
Exactly. Even the bubbles are doing a hammy turn in Wall Street 2. But it's back. Another big star is on the screen this week. Charlie St. Cloud, played by Zac Efron. Zan, High Street Musical. I know you've got all three of those and you absolutely love them.
He's a dreamboat.
Yeah. Here he is playing. He's a US soldier, is this right?
No.
No, he's not. Let me start again.
Unless
I don't know anything.
You were smoking some of Marx's favourite.
I've been up for... I went to that Mr. Marx premiere and never came down. I am living on a Charlie St. Cloud. Tell me, what about...
He's a yachtsman.
Is he?
Yeah, should we listen to a clip of him as a yachtsman?
Lovely.
See, rounding Cape Horn is where it gets tricky. The southern seas are tough for even the most experienced sailors because of
the... They're blood-sucking sea monkeys.
Icebergs.
Of course, the icebergs. You could never do this race.
Why? Why can't I do the race?
The solo race? You couldn't take being alone for 6 months. No way.
I could do it.
Oh, what? What if it wasn't for me, you could go?
No, Sam, I didn't say that. I just said I could. I won't. Of course, but I could.
Hey, don't let me stop you.
He's a yachtsman, a high school yachtsman from basically, I guess, the
a high school yachtsman.
High school yachtsman from like the wrong
yachts
side.
In my high school. The
Did
wrong,
they not?
The wrong
sure,
side
not
of the
Eton.
Lake.
But yeah, he's from the wrong side of the lake. And, you know, his mum's played by Kim Basinger, who is a nurse. And then he wins a scholarship, but then his little brother dies. I'm giving away all the plot here. But the little brother then comes back as a ghost, and then he has to play baseball with the ghost.
What,
and so
yachting.
He gives up everything.
Gives up yachting.
To play baseball with a ghost.
Gosh.
And then eventually there's a love of a good woman that might offer him a way back to the land of the living.
I'm so glad you've given that away because that sounds awful.
It is terrible. And it's all shot in that sort of honeyed light. Sort of de rigueur for these kind
Who's
of sensitive
the girl?
Films. The girl is she's name her name is Tess. She's played by Amanda Crew.
Never heard of
her. She plays a very distant second fiddle to Zac Efron.
Well, we all do.
So. We all do. You know, it's Ghost, it's Truly Madly Deeply, and it's altogether dull.
That sounds awful. The death and life of Charlie St. Cloud, thoroughly trashed by Zan. I'm glad I'm never going to have to see that film, even on DVD.
Tell me about a good film.
Yeah, I'll tell you about A Town Called Panic. We've been listening to some of the music from it. It's by a Belgian animating duo. There you go, but stay tuned, listeners. Do not turn off at that point. They're called Peek Peek André as a group. They've been doing sort of animations on, you may have seen some of their MTV kind of videos and stuff. They've taken little, they went around jumble sales and got little toys that children used to play play with. You know, those farmyard animals that you kind of have on bases sometimes, you know, they're just kind of like cows with all their feet there, but they're on that base. And they've made an animated world out of these kind of things. Sounds a little bit crazy, but I have to say it is a bit zany. But I actually, it's so mad, it actually works. It was only until after about an hour when the two little megalomaniac professors arrive and a giant iron penguin to kind of save the underwater world that I thought... This is
You're going with this. Right.
I went with this. It's about Monsieur Cheval, who lives with cowboy and Indian, and they try and build him a brick barbecue for his birthday, but they order too many bricks, and it sinks the town. And the farmer called Stephen, oh, mon tracteur, arrêtez! He goes a bit mental. He's played by Benoît Poelvoorde, you know, from Man Bites
Dog. No, you're just, it's like you're just babbling.
I might as well be, because the film is in the same vein. Yeah. And also Jeanne Balibar plays...
Oh, yeah, she played golf with him last week.
It's a she. She used to be married to Mathieu Amalric, and now she's playing Madame Longray, who runs the music conservatory, except she's a horse. And then this film does have two horses slow dancing.
No, I guess that she must be a horse.
Of course she's a horse.
Yeah.
Somehow this works. It is completely insane, but it is very, very funny indeed. Zan, for all of your reviews and your very heartfelt tribute to one of your favourites, Norman Wisdom.
Norman Wisdom. I modelled my life.
And your outfits on Norman Wisdom. He's there giving it all on guardian.co.uk/film. Tim Hetherington is a British photographer who won the 2007 World Press Photo Competition for his picture of a tired American soldier covering his face with his hand after a tough day's fighting in the Korangal Valley in East Afghanistan. That work was made for Vanity Fair magazine, with whom Tim is a contributing photographer, and indeed he's made several trips to Afghanistan with writer Sebastian Younger to cover the war there. Younger and Hetherington have now collaborated, turning their experiences into a documentary called simply Restrepo, named after that outpost on a rocky outcrop in the Korangal Valley. And I'm delighted to say that Tim Hetherington is in the Film Weekly studio with me now. I don't need to duck, do I, Tim? I think the danger follows you around.
I don't know. Clearly. I'm more wondering what's going to happen. So maybe if I get on the table, you know, you're
well, if you don't know. I mean, is it? I mean, there is something about your work is absolutely beautiful.
Thank you.
But it's also, you know, incredibly bone shaking. I describe it, especially in this documentary, The Restrepo. Is there something that attracts you about the danger? What is it that makes you kind of go into these places? I'm glad you do, but I'm glad I don't.
You know, it's kind of something that I fell into almost. You know, I first started working as a photographer for The Big Issue many, many moons ago, and I had no expectation. If you said to me then you're going to end up covering wars, and I would have said you're absolutely joking. I never intended to do that. That all changed for me when somebody got me to go to Liberia back in 99, and the world I encountered there was very different from my own, and it's drawn me into this covering conflicts. And, you know, Restrepo, we spent over 10 months filming in an outpost on the side of a mountain. And, you know, I can now, that's my skill set. It's a weird kind of skill set.
Yeah.
And
hopefully you won the World Press Photo in 2007 for a picture of a US soldier after a day's fighting in the Korangal Valley. Is that where we got the footage for Restrepo? Is that the same
It was during the same time. I went to Afghanistan with my colleague, Sebastian Younger from Vanity Fair. We're both, he's the writer, I'm the photographer. We went out there and to cover one platoon for an entirety of their deployment. And I was both shooting video, as was Sebastian, and also photographing. And Restrepo was the product, is the film that grew organically out of those experiences.
I mean, it's a fascinating story. It's a little story. I mean, it's kind of basically, it reminded me, I've written in a review, that it's kind of more to do with the First World War, Great War, than it is with modern warfare. And we're talking about, you know, soldiers advancing under great danger of only a few yards and building a trench. I mean, it really could be something from the Somme.
Well, you know, I think that soldiering hasn't really changed for millennia. I'm guessing that the platoon of soldiers at Restrepo would be fairly like a platoon of soldiers in the First World War, would be like a group of soldiers at the Siege of Troy.
Mac just popped a dude.
Hey, who just popped who?
Mac?
That was one all white.
Mac just popped somebody?
That's That's what he just said.
We are in the West often want to sanitize war. We represent war through images of missiles or tanks or helicopters, when in reality, take a group of young men, train them together, put them on the side of a mountain, and they will kill and be killed for each other. And the war machine is very much human and very intimate. And it's something that we try to dehumanize as we try to sanitize war.
Tell me about the commission. Was obviously that you were going to follow the platoon for, well, I don't know, what was their deployment? How long
their
was
deployment,
it?
Well, American soldiers do 15 months. They're about 13 months in the Corps.
Tour of duty, I think is the correct, that's what I should have been. Right. I mean, I get all my vocab from war films, you know, and my images too.
We'll be sending you over there soon.
I don't think it'll be much use. But are you what you would call an embed in this situation?
Absolutely. And it was my first time embedded with US forces. And I really thought before I went out there, I'm going to be censored. In fact, I didn't have to show anybody anything. In fact, there was no oversight of us. We were far from the bureaucratic controls of the US military. We were in this tiny outpost on the side of a mountain in the most remote valley that was seeing a huge amount of fighting. And we were just kind of left to our own devices. And, you know, we mined the embed system, this embedded reporter system, in a way that hasn't been mined before, just by going off and staying for a long period of time, that we basically became part of the platoon. Although I never carried a gun. I never went on guard duty, although occasionally they try and wake me up in the night to see if I'd fall for that.
Right, so you became, I mean, you get the slight camera, you know, you got teased. Absolutely. As one of the lads. Because I do think the film, I don't know if that was your intention or not, but it does kind of, whilst you've been with these soldiers, there still is a sort of brutality and futility about war in general that comes out, even though, you know, if you're a military man, you don't think war is futile.
I think the film in many ways is like a Rorschach test in terms of you see what you want in it, and it doesn't take a political line because the soldiers weren't talking about politics. And because we send you on this 90-minute deployment, all the action takes place in the valley and there are no politicians to give the big picture because the soldiers don't have access to that. We just felt that we didn't want our own political judgment to cloud your experience.
Your film uses first-person testimony, clearly shot a few months after they get back, when they're clearly still traumatize some of the troops by this, and sort of mention the post-traumatic stress kind of disorder that's gone on. Did you know that that's how you're going to structure it after you'll say, well, I'll take all this footage while I'm there and then we'll kind of deal with it when we get back? Or is that an afterthought that you kind of thought, well, this will help me piece together what we've all been through?
I mean, you know, as I said, the film was like an organic process, and, you know, we shot 160 hours of Verite, and then we kind of thought, well, how do we sew it together? We didn't want Morgan Freeman doing the kind of commentary on March of the Corongal. You know, we decided that we wanted to have the soldiers tell their story as well, to keep you in the sense that you're in the valley, not to break that illusion. So we said, okay, let's go to Ickley where they're based. We'll do these post-deployment interviews. We turned up 3 months after they got back to base. What we hadn't expected was for the PTSD to be full-blown by that stage.
What's that?
Post-traumatic stress disorder. And many of the soldiers, you know, the soldiers were not in a particularly good way when we turned up. And we turned up not as military authority figures, not as the company shrink, not as their family whom they have difficulty relating these experiences to. We turned up as friends who could pinpoint experiences. And they really opened up to us and made some of those interviews are really some of the most remarkable footage in the film, I think.
They have brilliant recall and very kind of vivid narratives that they create.
Yeah, sometimes, you know, I mean, I don't think that Hollywood casting could have given us a more interesting set of characters than what we have. And in fact, that, again, bears testimony that real life is more interesting than fiction.
Yeah, I love the scenes where you go into the village and speak to the, what are they called, those the meetings that you have with them?
The kind of Shura meetings, the Shuras, the elders. Yeah,
yeah. The elders, where they kind of obviously they're kind of saying, well, we'll give you some money and you'll have a road and then, you know, and you. They're inscrutable, these elders.
It's interesting that a lot of people are really are interested by that material, because you realise that you have never really been presented that in the news.
No.
There's lots of short network news pieces out there. We have these political op-ed pieces, but this really is the first film of its kind to take you for 90 minutes into that reality.
Well, it's one of the jobs that the army are doing. It's a kind Absolutely. Of hearts and minds operation. It's not easy, though, to be going on the shores. The trust and the kind of... The reason for it all kind of, as I said, as you said, my Rorschach test is I read a sort of futility and what on earth is going on here.
Yeah.
What state will we be leaving Afghanistan in?
You know, that's very hard to tell. I mean, we're in the middle of the surge and we'll see what happens, you know, towards the end of the year, what state of play we're in. But I mean, you know, hearts and minds isn't about giving bear hugs and high fives to village elders. It's about giving them a reasonable chance of security. You know, interestingly, when the US went into Afghanistan in 2001. Afghans, 90% opinion polls said that they were in favor of what had happened, getting rid of the Taliban. They weren't popular. But then, you know, both Britain and the US turned its attention to Iraq and left 19,000 soldiers in Afghanistan. I mean, I live in New York City. There's 40,000 cops there. You know, the message that I sent to the Afghan people was pretty plain and clear. It was like, we're not really, you know, that focused on what's happening. And so no wonder the war slipped out of control. And no wonder the Afghans, you know, have to side with the insurgents or else they'll get their heads cut off.
And you're going back there?
Yeah, we will go back. I mean, we'll continue to report for Vanity Fair there. I mean, that's our job. And, you know, it's interesting. You get to a point in your work where you start to have access in getting your message out and your information out. And that has a kind of responsibility with it as well. And, you know, I'll continue doing this up to a point in which I suddenly say, perhaps it's, you know, it's time for me to do something else.
Mm. Well, it's a remarkable film. I hope you don't get shot at too often. Either verbally by critics of what you're propagating or by the Taliban or by any friendly fire or anything like that. Tim Hetherington, thanks very much for coming on.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Thanks to Tim Hetherington there. For more information on where you can see Restrepo, it's screening in the UK from this Friday, but you'll need to visit their website, restrepothemovie.com or dogwoof.com. More sterling work from those very interesting distributors at Dogwoof. Thanks to all my guests this week, indeed, to Bernard Rose and to Zam Brooks. The music you've been listening to is from the hilarious and brilliantly bonkers Belgian film, A Town Called Panic, which I discussed with Zam Brooks earlier. Monsieur Cheval, ho 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 ho! Don't forget to pick up a copy of The Observer this Sunday for my trailer trash column, of course. And do join us on Facebook, Film Weekly Fans, that's us. You can post your thoughts there and your requests. We answer anything. You can follow me on Twitter as well, Jason Critic or Film Weekly. We're all over the world here. From me, Jason Solomons, and my producer on Film Weekly, Jason Phipps, it's goodbye until next week.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.